To all you boppers out there in the big city, welcome to Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
On the internet where nobody dared to go. This is Film School Reject's completely unironic exploitation and cult film appreciation podcast that is so good, it just has to be bad for you. What is the World Wide Web version of the FDA? Does that exist? Is that a thing?
No.
Good.
Okay. No. Have you been on the internet before? Because there's not really any, you know, judgment of taste. Even the places that upvote and downvote taste, which might be, I don't know, maybe like Reddit, often has no taste.
The tastemakers. It's like the emperor has no clothes. The tastemakers have no taste.
1 million people like this. Well, that doesn't make it good, okay? No. No.
Well, this is Junk Food Cinema. I'm your host, Brian Steak Pliskin Salisbury, and I'm joined by my compatriot, fellow traveler through the wastelands of cinema, novelist slash screenwriter slash C. Robert Cargill.
Slash C. Robert Cargill.
You should write some slash fic.
No.
I think you should. I really, really.
You don't want to read that because I'm.
I don't want to read it. I'm just saying you should write it.
No. That would not turn out well for anyone involved.
Well, hey, guys. Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes. If you just search for Junk Food Cinema in their podcast section, you can also find us on Stitcher. And you can check out the written version, even though we now are more able to, I guess, have words, you might say, in the podcast version. The written version is still available here on Film School Rejects. Also want to let you guys know that we're going to start putting up Amazon links for the movies that we talk about that are actually available for purchase on Amazon. If you would, please, if you're considering buying those things, use our Amazon links. That helps us out. We appreciate that. Even if you don't buy that particular thing, whatever you buy, you know, actually does.
A little credit for that.
We keep the lights on. Yeah, absolutely. There is a word that comes to mind as I struggle to classify today's episode. What is that word? Oh, yeah. Magic. Whole lot of magic. One of the things that we always want to do here on Junk Food Cinema is to introduce you guys to the films that have slipped through the cracks of time, that have been mislabeled as garbage and not given their proper due. That being said, we also want to shine a spotlight on the artist who not only thrived during some of our favorite niche eras, but helped to craft the identities of those eras as well. And today, we bring you a retrospective of one of those figures, a man too cool for the business, I guess.
somebody who's one of my deep fried favorites as far as support, you know, in terms of the era that he's in and what he did and who he was and who he should have been.
Who he should have been, absolutely.
It's interesting. This is the episode that caused this podcast to happen. Brian and I were sitting around talking about various things one night, just knocking back beers at my place. And he started talking about this, and I talked about how cool it would be because I often run into, you know, actors or movies when I'm going through stuff at home, and I'm like, why? I really want to talk about this, or I really want to talk about this guy, because nobody, whoever talks about these people, or whoever talks about this movie. And at the time, what I was thinking about was this movie called Battle Truck, and its star Michael Beck. And Michael Beck is ostensibly the what's the best way to why am I blanking on his name all of a sudden? I always do this. That's why the guy who played Legolas.
Orlando Bloom.
Orlando Bloom. He's the Orlando Bloom of his time. He is this young, good-looking, athletic guy who was given a shot, should have hit, and was supposed to be a big star, and then never was.
Yeah.
And then just all of a sudden fell through the cracks and all but vanished.
And it should be stated, through no fault of his own. Like, this isn't a guy who, like, had drug problems or was a problem to work with or it was –
or that people hated.
It's just for whatever reason, there was a small window of time when he was popular, when he was marketable, I guess. And when that window closed, it never really reopened. Like, that's not to say he hasn't worked, but he's worked mostly in television and has kind of faded into obscurity in that way. Like, he's on a lot of shows in very small bit parts, couple episode runs, but he's never really been given anything in the way of a leading role ever again.
But he's had this 5-movie window. And I have my theory, and we'll talk about the theories as to why he never caught on. But he had this 5-movie window in which he made 3 really notable films.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're into, you know, junk food cinema type movies at all, you know all 3 of those films. You've probably seen them. And if you haven't, you feel bad for not having seen them. They're the type of films you often lie about having seen and giggle along at the jokes other people make, trying to pretend that nobody knows that you haven't seen them. And then 2 films that most people haven't seen, both of which are good, but one of them is legitimately really good and should not have been forgotten.
Definitely.
And that movie, which you've heard us talk about several times, Battle Truck, inspired this whole thing because we really wanted to talk about this kind of thing. And so, of course, Michael Beck, everyone knows him as the lead character in The Warriors.
Yes.
And so I think we should start there. And I think we should talk about, you know, his big breakout role of The Warriors.
Absolutely. So let's get started with this retrospective of Michael Beck with The Warriors. Which is, of course, Walter Hill's seminal gang movie from 1979. But it should be stated, in no way the only gang movie from 1979.
No.
In fact, that same year, there was The Warriors, The Wanderers, Walk Proud, and ones that didn't begin with W. Boulevard Nights was the 4th one to come out that year. And then just a couple years later, Escape from New York. So you can kind of wrap your head around what was going on in America in the late 70s and a lot of the sort of chaotic discontent of urban street use. And you get a movie like The Warriors, which is it's based on a book by Saul Urich. And the book was written as – to give you an idea of when the book was written, it was written as a reaction to the over-cutesifying of street gangs in West Side Story. Saul Urich really didn't like the fact that New York street gang culture had kind of been requisitioned as a flowery Hollywood musical. So he writes this really – kind of, I mean, the book is much darker even than, and that's not to say that the Warriors movie is flowery.
No.
But the book is super dark, and the book not only kind of is a reaction against West Side Story, but it's bringing in Greek mythology at the same time. It's the story of Anabasis, which is this, it's by a sort of an epic poem, a piece of literature by Xenophon, and it's the Greek army. This group of mercenaries are hired by Cyrus the Younger when he's trying to seize the Persian throne.
Can you dig it?
Can you dig it? Already you're starting to understand the character names in this movie. So Cyrus the Younger hires these Greek mercenaries to help him take the throne in Persia. But suddenly these Greek mercenaries find themselves behind enemy lines 1,000 miles from home. And they have to go like through all this enemy-filled territory to get back to the sea. That's also obviously the structure, the basic structure of the Warriors on a smaller scale. So, I mean, not only do you have a film that is vehemently anti-Hollywood in a lot of ways, but is also bringing in a very classic story, which is, of course, why if you got the Ultimate Edition Blu-ray and that change where it starts with a highly sort of Frank Miller stylized recounting of this ancient Greek story, that's entirely why.
Yeah. Well, what makes The Warriors so interesting is that not only is it good and not only is it just fundamentally solid, it has the odd quality that it was trying to predict the future in a certain way.
Yes.
And they zigged when everyone else zagged and they got it really, really wrong. In fact, the movie I most liken it to is Hackers. In which Hackers is trying to figure out where geek culture was going to be a few years down the road and feel futuristic, and instead totally, totally missed the point. And so we end up with all of these gangs that they don't have the racial divisions that you had so much in actual gang culture. And rather than going with a very normalized approach, as most gangs did, they're super stylized. to the point of ridiculousness, like roller skating gangs with overalls and mime gangs and
the baseball furies.
The baseball furies, and just and it's so stylized in the weirdest ways that make it awesome.
Yeah, and it should be mentioned, by the way, that the baseball furies are based on the band Kiss, based on Walter Hill's affinity for the band Kiss. I always thought that was cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, another thing about you're right. I think there is a sort of misapperception, if that's even the word I'm trying to use, of the future, because, I mean, the movie even opens up with, like, sometime in the future is what it says.
Yeah.
So he's in – Walter Hill's envisioning a world, or even maybe Saul Urich is envisioning a world where New York has been completely taken over by gangs. I mean, there is not a normal person to be found who's not a cop in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, 90% of it takes place at night, but it's like it's New York. If it were regular New York, you would still see regular people. But, I mean, I think there's, like, there are cops and there's one, like, candy stand vendor. And all the other normal people are completely absent. It's like they've been wiped out by a plague and gangs have completely taken over. And what I find interesting about that is that Walter Hill's original idea was to make the Warriors an all-black gang. And Paramount balked at the idea. So you're right. Within the version we got, the Warriors are actually pretty – you know, racially diverse.
Yeah.
There's a few different races, like, all within this one, you know, under this one flag of the Warriors. But originally the idea was to have it be an all-black gang. And that's kind of why the Gramercy Riffs are not really the antagonists of the movie. They're more like the I mean, if you haven't seen the Warriors, okay, the basic plot is that the Warriors and all of the gangs of New York are called to this big meeting in Central Park, and they're all going to be united under one leader who is called Cyrus, again, based on Anabasis. So Cyrus gets up and is giving this speech about how, look around you, we have more numbers than the police, this city is ours, and everyone's kind of getting behind it, but there's this one gang who thrive on chaos, who don't really like the idea of order being brought to things, so just for the shit of it, they assassinate Cyrus and make it look like the Warriors did it, and then the Warriors are basically being hunted by every other gang as they try to get back to Coney Island, which is their home. So that's the basic structure of the Warriors. And I think what I find interesting about the way that that's set up is that we talked about on the show before about what New York was like before Giuliani.
Yeah.
And I don't think, like, the movie's vision of the future is it, you know, much like hackers couldn't actually hypothesize what the internet would be. Walter Hill had no way to hypothesize what New York would be like after Giuliani.
Yeah. But rooting all of this, bringing us all the way back around, is this movie is anchored by Michael Beck.
Michael Beck as War Chief Swan of the Warriors.
And he's badass.
He is super bad. I mean, he's one of those guys that he's the kind of hero who doesn't say much, but he's also doesn't have a problem saying what's on his mind when he needs to. He's a very pragmatic leader. He's very level-headed. I mean, he's in a street gang, and they talk about brawling all the time, but he knows exactly when a fight is necessary and when it is disadvantageous. I mean, he's a great leader.
And the thing is you look at this guy, and you never for a minute question why this wiry little white guy is in charge of this gang.
Because
he's just – and this is why this movie got him all of the roles that would come after and why it's what he's best known for. He just – he oozes charisma. And he just he almost has this young Clint Eastwood quality about him.
Very much so.
Where he just does so much with his eyes that says, dude, you're up fucked creek right now because I'm about to beat the shit out of you. And that becomes the hallmark of what he does with almost every other role.
Yeah.
I think there's two major roles that he had that you know, diverge from that a bit, and we'll get into those. But the core of what he is and why he kept getting those roles is just because he portrayed that menace,
mm-hmm.
and you bought it.
What's important to note about Beck in this movie is how he got the role. He was discovered almost by accident. Basically what happened was Walter Hill was working on this little movie called Alien. And so he was watching a movie from 1978, 1979 called Madman.
From Israel.
Yeah, because he was checking out this very unknown actress named Sigourney Weaver because they were considering her for Alien. And in that same movie, Michael Beck's performance so impressed him that he brought him in for an audition. And he won the role of Swan, which was originally considered for – man, I feel this – like I can't even – formulate this image in my head. Tony Danza. Tony Danza turned
and
down...
And three orangutans. And Tony Danza and three orangutans were going to be the leader of the Warriors that was with all the rest of the characters.
Yeah, it was going to be Any Which Way But Warriors, I think, was what it was going to be called. So Tony Danza decides that he's going to do Taxi instead, which ended up being huge for him. Don't get me wrong. But the Warriors would have been... Like, I'm thinking about the... If I can even say this...
What was the Tony Danza movie? Didn't he do Hollywood Nights? Was that the movie?
Did he do Hollywood Nights?
Was that the Tony Danza-led gang movie?
Oh, my God. Is there actually a Tony Danza? I was just about to say that in the oeuvre of Tony Danza, which is a weird thing to say in and of itself, I couldn't remember.
No, don't ever say that phrase again. Like, no, the oeuvre of Tony Danza I think we just opened a rift to somewhere.
I literally can't wrap my head around the idea of a Tony Danza Warriors. It kind of hurts my brain a little bit. But yeah, so Michael Beck gets this role almost accidentally because he happens to be in this movie along with Sigourney Weaver, who was a no-name actress at the time.
And F. Murray Abraham.
And F. Murray Abraham, just because Walter Hill, who's not even directing Alien, but is watching this movie to consider... I mean, like, the universe, like, all of the planets aligned and the exact perfect way to give us Michael Beck, and then they just fucking took it away.
They took it away.
Damn you, universe. How cool is Beck in this film? Well, I will tell you this. Ronald Reagan saw the movie during his presidency at Camp David and called Michael Beck to tell him how much he enjoyed it. Nice. So Michael Beck literally got a call from the president of the goddamn United States.
Ronnie.
Well, I saw the movie, thought you were great. I'm going to eat some jelly beans now.
Well, hey, Reagan was a bad actor for years. So.
That's true.
Yeah. I say that. No, Reagan was very good in a number of films.
But yeah, The Warriors is just, I mean, it's an incredible movie for a lot of different, I mean, we could go on and on and on about why The Warriors is great.
And you dig it!
But most people have, so let's talk about the ones that people don't talk about.
You're absolutely right. And coming up next on the retrospective is a personal favorite of my co-host here. Do you want to discuss the outfit you wore to Convergence a few years ago?
Nobody should ever have to hear about that. No, the next film, of course, is Megaforce.
These are not chronological, but I knew that if we didn't talk about Megaforce pretty much right out of the gate, that Cargill would have a conniption.
I was fine with going chronological, but Megaforce is actually interesting in terms of Beck's career because it's the one in which Beck is the most different from any of his other roles.
Yes, yes, very much. I mean, he's still a hero, but he's
the goofy sidekick.
He is the goofy sidekick. He is, like, if you imagine Megaforce and you put it next to a movie like The Warriors, he's not Swan. He's more like Cochise or Ajax. Like, he's just a more exaggerated character.
He's more like Matthew Lillard in the various... Matthew Lillard always played a role next to Freddie Prinze Jr. Like, they did six movies together, I want to say. And Matthew Lillard was always the plucky, goofy comic relief that was coming in and yucking it up so that, you know, Freddie Prinze Jr. looked, you know, it humanized him and you could deal with the fact that he was, you know, he was always playing the straight man. And that's what he does here. He plays this southern yuckety up kid on this anti-terrorism team known as Megaforce.
Now, Megaforce is directed by the godfather of movie mayhem, Mr. Hal Needham, who unfortunately we lost at the end of last year.
Yeah.
I mean,
King of the stuntmen.
I mean, Hal Needham invented the car chase. I mean, for all intents and purposes, like, the guy invented the modern cinematic car. I mean, like,
you say for all intents and purposes, he invented most of the gear that was then used for car chases that allowed the type of car chases that we all grew up with.
He
invented so many rigs, and I do an episode of Harry Knowles' show where we spend a bulk of the half an hour sitting around talking about all the various things that Hal Needham came up with, and it's unreal because he really did change stunt work forever and was just brilliant. And he directed this little film called Smokey and the Bandit, and he directed a little film called Cannonball Run.
Cannonball Run.
He directed a little film called Hooper.
Yeah.
And then he got this script he wanted to do, which was a kind of a G.I. Joe send-up.
It is G.I. Joe. It is every bit G.I. Joe.
It is G.I. Joe. It was, he wanted to make a kid's movie with stuntmen, and so he and a bunch of his buddies went out into the desert and shot one of the dumbest movies ever made, and did so having fun the entire time, and that fun actually shows through and makes the movie magical in its own right.
I mean, you have a group of paramilitary dudes who are defined entirely by their divergent, almost cartoonish personalities and their awesome armored vehicles. This is a G.I. Joe movie.
Yeah. It's like, hey, what's cooler than motorcycles? How about armored motorcycles with guns and missiles that shoot colored smoke out their asses?
Yeah.
Well, what's the coolest kind of car we could have? How about a dune buggy? Well, what could we put lasers on it? Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. We can put lasers on those dune buggies.
Oh, you say that. Obama actually quoted Megaforce in his campaign.
Shut the fuck up. Are you serious?
I swear to God.
Did he say deeds, not words?
Yes.
Oh my God.
What we need in this country is deeds, not words. And I was like, oh my God, I wrote an article about it on Spill about how Obama was going to.
He just won your vote, if nothing else.
Was about to create Megaforce. And everyone's like, what the fuck's Megaforce? And I'm like, you better learn, son.
Wow.
You better respect deeds, not words, of course, the slogan of Megaforce. I mean, it really is. It's just a stupid kids movie about all these guys with all their really cool gadgets. It's terrible at moments. I mean, absolutely terrible. It makes the kind of mistakes, the basic screenwriting mistakes you're not supposed to make. One of my favorites, and I use this as an example when I talk to young screenwriters, is there's a scene in which Michael Beck is showing off the mad doctor's inventions, and he's showing this invisibility like thing on one of the vehicles, and he puts a drink on the vehicle, and we see the vehicle disappear, the drink disappear, and it's like, oh, this is cool. This is going to come up later, right?
No,
we're never seeing that again.
Look, like in every screenwriting textbook that you read, if there's an invisible car in the first act, it's called the invisible car in the first act rule. That invisible car has to show up again. Like, it is basic elements of filmmaking.
Never again. And the movie is just, it's stupid, it's goofy, but it's fun to watch.
It's more fun than, for my money, it's more fun than Rise of Cobra. I'm sorry, I had way more fun watching Megaforce than I did the actual fucking G.I. Joe movie.
Yeah, it is ostensibly a G.I. Joe movie. And for that era, I mean, it was totally marketed to kids. I remember the advertisements for it and every comic book that came out for like 2 months in advance had, hey kids, go to your local movie theater and get your Megaforce kit so you could be ready when the movie comes out. And it came out in the greatest summer ever.
1982.
The summer of 82, and it came out, I think the week it came out did it come out the week of E.T.? It came out one of the crazy weeks where it just got creamed. Like, there was no way, no matter how good it was up against 1982, for those of you that don't know, is the single most classic summer in the history of cinema.
Yeah.
And there's literally every week is a classic film that came out.
It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd when you start looking at all the movies that came out in the summer of 1982.
Yeah. You can make a top 10 list of the summer of 82, and you and have your buddy make it. They're going to be different lists, but you're both going to love every movie on both lists.
Absolutely.
And for my money, one of the best, worst movies of that year is Megaforce. And Michael Beck is just... Michael Beck was a poor Southern kid who was really smart and went
He's
to college.
He's from Tennessee.
He's from Tennessee, went to college, got a degree, then turned that... He got a degree in economics, of all things.
Yeah, because he went as a football scholarship. Mm-hmm. So
he played football and got an economics degree and then went to the School of Drama, which I think means he had to revoke his economics degree by going into acting.
You have demonstrated a lack of understanding how economics actually works if you think that you can actually make it as an actor. But for a very short period of time, this brief window we're talking about, he actually did.
Yeah, and he's actually a lot of fun in this movie. He's actually almost more memorable than Barry Bostwick is.
He's entirely more memorable than Barry Bostwick.
Barry Bostwick has the most memorable lines in the movie.
Sure.
You know, like
and the most memorable hairdo.
Quotes, you know, the good guys always win, even in the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. But Michael Beck in this movie is playing a character called Dallas, who is the most exaggerated Texan I think I've ever seen in a movie. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, Slim Pickens, you got it. You've got the overdrawn Texan shtick down pat. No one's going to take that from you. But Michael Beck's character Dallas is like such an insane cowboy. Like he could not be more broadly drawn. And yet, because of the charisma of Michael Beck, that supersedes how annoying that character should be.
Yeah.
That character should get on your nerves from frame one, but he doesn't because of Michael Beck.
Yeah. And this leads to one of the really sad things about why I think his career tanked like it did. This is one of two roles that came out in the same year in which he was nominated for the Razzie.
The damn Razzies, man.
And he was, the Razzies of all things. We have very strong opinions on the Razzies.
That they're worthless? That they're as worthless as the actual Oscar is?
And they hate celebrity. I mean, they do. They deliberately attack celebrity. They don't really go after the worst stuff. They go after the prominent people that they want to kick while they're down.
I mean, Sandra Bullock nailed them.
Sandra Bullock made them irrelevant. I mean, that was the last time anybody took the Razzies anywhere near seriously, when she showed up to receive her award and she walked on stage carrying a wheelbarrow full of her movie and saying, well, I figured nobody here had actually seen the movie, so I brought a copy for everybody. You're not allowed to leave without it. And she did it with so much style and grace and then turned right around the next day and got the Oscar.
Yeah.
And in the same year.
It was that thing she said. None of you have actually seen the movie. And that's what you're saying. They just go after celebrity. They're not even concerned with the movies that they're you know, supposedly skewering.
So he got, worst supporting actor, which, come on.
Bullshit.
Not even close for that year. I mean, there's some really awful stuff in 82 as well. I mean, you can fill that up mostly with Cue the Winged Serpent, and which I love for a completely different reason, but it's still not a good movie.
But it's funny because all I'm thinking about now is how Michael Moriarty Cue the Winged Serpent probably should have gotten the Razzie, but at the same time, I'm still like, that's a hell of a performance. That guy like throws himself head over heels into Cue the Winged Serpent.
He ad-libbed that whole movie. It's amazing. but Michael Beck really took it on the chin for that and for another film, which we should probably go into now, which is...
The thing you need to understand about Xanadu is, one, I had never seen it until we started preparing for this show, and I knew about it because my father really liked this movie, and I was like, really? Because it seems like the complete opposite of everything else that you like in film. But then I slowly started to realize, no, it is a cinematic oddity, which is something that my dad actually likes a lot.
It's a weird, weird film. It's one of those films that you have a hard time believing really exists.
Yeah.
And is so much more entertaining than it probably should be. And I hate saying that. That's why I don't say it has any right to be.
Yeah.
But it really is kind of a big, ugly train wreck trying to be something that was really out of date and missing the mark, but having so much talent behind it in certain areas that you can't help but enjoy watching it.
Well, that's the thing, is it's hypnotic. It's a hypnotic train wreck, kind of like the Apple. I want to understand what the hell happened with this. Like, I am intrigued by the pieces that are here, and I want to know what went wrong or what somebody was thinking. And the other thing you need to understand about Xanadu is that Michael Beck himself said this: the Warriors opened a lot of doors in film for me, which Xanadu then closed.
Yeah.
So Xanadu, is, at least in Michael Beck's mind, is the reason he's not working anymore.
Well, Xanadu, he also was nominated for a Razzie.
Yeah.
And Xanadu, of course,
is... Which is stupid.
Olivia
because,
Newton-John.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
we'll go into that.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
But it's Olivia Newton-John starring as a muse, another Greek story.
Mm-hmm.
Starring as a muse who falls in love with Michael Beck, a young artist, and ends up connecting him with... Gene Kelly, the dancer, and
who was, contrary to popular belief, still alive at this point in history.
He was, and he was in the sun was setting on his career. He was growing old, and he they brought all these elements together to kind of make a movie about how awesome style is in both retro and modern. Mm-hmm. And they blend a bunch of styles together, and kind of the whole movie is about building kind of their dream nightclub,
right,
that kind of caters to everyone. And it's a musical with amazing music that's still really great by ELO.
Yeah, ELO's – that's the thing, is most people don't know Xanadu the movie. Most people know Xanadu the soundtrack.
Yeah.
That soundtrack is incredible. With, I'll say this, as a supposedly straight man, I love the theme song to Xanadu.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Yeah, every straight man is allowed to love anything that Olivia Newton-John is a part of or ELO
she's
is a part
so
of.
She's so adorable.
She is.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And she's great in the movie. In fact, they're all great in the movie, and that's the thing, is that I don't think Michael Beck is bad in the movie at all. The movie's just not particularly good.
It's inexplicable.
Yeah.
It is inexplicable. Like, the things, I mean...
It makes me happy is what it does.
Yeah, it kind of does because there's just a fearlessness about it. It's so anti-form. It's literally about what it feels like to be inspired. And you can't really fault the movie for taking that inspiration and running with it to the fullest extent of the idea. Like, they are just kind of unrelentingly creative in this movie, and they're throwing too much – they're throwing, like, too much creativity at the screen, and that's why it doesn't work because you have all these elements – that don't really coalesce, that are on screen at the same time. And yet, there's something mesmerizing about it. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I'm actually entertained by what's happening on screen. I think it's interesting that Michael Beck's career effectively begins and ends with two movies that are rooted in Greek mythology, because it makes his career even more of a Greek tragedy.
Yeah.
it makes it so much more tragic. It feels like the real inspiration for this movie, like the real catalyst, was Aren't Roller Discos Awesome?
Yes.
And for like 3 weeks while the movie was being made, yes, they were.
Well, it's another deep fried favorite of ours. Yeah. Is, I mean, roller disco movies. We're going to do a whole entire thing on roller disco movies.
I know what you're
movies.
About to bring.
Oh,
up.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Skate Town USA.
Which
sadly has no Michael Beck.
No.
But is an amazing film in its own right. And we will talk about that in a future date, because that is, holy God, is that an amazing movie in its own right.
Xanadu is pure zeitgeist. I mean, it's the capturing of the dying ember of a short-lived trend. It's,
yeah.
I feel like it perfectly encapsulates Michael Beck. I mean, he was a man who was perfect for that moment in time in which he thrived, and then the time shifted and he was left behind,
yeah.
Much like Xanadu. Xanadu has a shelf life of like 3 weeks as far as relevance goes.
Yeah.
And if you didn't see it within those 3 weeks, the movie is completely anachronistic from start to finish.
What?
And not just the like 30s dance numbers either. Not the big band Glenn Miller stuff. The overall aesthetic of Xanadu becomes anachronistic 3 weeks after it's released.
Yeah. Which is it never, you know, every movie he was a part of just kind of missed the boat.
Yeah.
In some way, shape, or form.
And that brings us to, again, the movie that really inspired this show. And I was wondering how long we could go before we actually did talk about Battle Truck.
How long did we go?
4 episodes.
Well, this is our
fourth episode, so 3 episodes we went before we actually talked about Battle Truck.
Battle Truck.
Battle Truck. Sounds like a toy that I wish would have bought as a kid.
That's how many episodes it took before you watched Battle Truck, because I had seen it and was telling you how you needed to see this movie. And how good is Battle Truck?
Battle Truck's kind of fucking awesome. I am not going to lie. Battle Truck, which is from 1982. And again, you have to remember, everything we're talking about, I believe everything we're talking about within the career of Michael Beck takes place from 1979 until 1982. Like, that is the window we're talking about.
Yeah, his last movie came out in 83, but he was shooting his last stuff in 81 and 82.
Yeah.
That feature stuff. Because immediately after his, what was ostensibly his fifth feature to come out, he was doing entirely TV work on
right.
and off. But we'll talk about that
anyway,
in a moment. Let's get on to
Battle Truck.
Battle Truck, a.k.a. Warlords of the 21st Century.
Now, which is the cooler title, you think? Battle Truck or Warlords of the 21st Century?
Battle Truck.
Okay.
First of all, the movie involves a battle truck.
It does.
It has
literally a battle truck.
There are no warlords in this movie.
This is not a Troll 2 situation. Like, it delivers on what the title promises.
Oh, yeah. No, it's like, what is there a truck? Yes. And in fact, the truck is awesome.
It is equipped for battle in more ways than one.
It is amazing. Okay, so let me give you the setup of Battle Truck.
Do it.
Battle Truck is a partially Corman-produced film made in New Zealand, shot in 1981 by Harley Koklis, this is a guy who got his big start as the second unit director on a little thing called Empire Strikes Back.
Yep.
And then, of course, he ended up, the first cinematographer didn't work out, so he brought in a second cinematographer a week and a half in, Chris Menges, who's an Academy Award winning cinematographer for The Killing Fields and The Mission, and who has shot dozens of movies, has been nominated for 4 Oscars, won 2. And Chris Menges is really the star of this movie. The cinematography in this movie is so good. They had such a low budget, and he was such a good cinematographer that since they were making a Western, what they did was they shot it like an old school Western with a lot of long shots, mm-hmm. a lot of establishing shots, and a lot of very cool angles, including the titular shot, which is, you know, a dead on shot of a mounted camera right on looking at the battle truck. At the battle truck is racing forward. It's this very kind of duel like shot.
Yeah.
And for 15 minutes, we're treated to the story of this girl who is for some reason on the battle truck, who's trying to escape the battle truck. And 15 minutes into the movie, we meet our film's protagonist, Hunter, played by Michael Beck.
Mr. Michael Beck. And it's funny, Megaforce, the hero's name is Hunter, that isn't played by Michael Beck. And
that's
here
Ace Hunter.
Ace Hunter.
And this is Hunter.
Hunter, just Hunter. Yeah, like, you're right. There, in fact, one of the things I remember thinking when I watched it is there's this shootout that happens, like, at his cabin, at Hunter's cabin, that is dead on a Western.
Yeah.
It absolutely, I mean, it's the outlaws are coming to take the girl, or it is a classic Western setup, and the battle truck, the name battle truck, was not the original title. Warlords of the 21st Century was the original title. And obviously,
but even the director refers to it as Battle Truck.
Right, no.
Like, clearly this is the name that everybody knows this movie.
Right, but I feel like it two reasons. One being the Battle Truck itself, while not the most important thing in the film, is the most marketable thing in the film. So I can completely understand that title change. Also, I'm not really sure there's a single warlord in this movie. The bad guy in this film, Straker, is like General or Colonel Straker is his name. He's not really a warlord. He's a guy who is just
going, the leader of the outlaws.
He's going to survive.
He's El Guapo.
This takes place after the Great Gasoline Wars,
the oil wars,
World War III, because it's a post-apocalyptic film. So you have to name the cataclysm. In this case, it's the oil wars or World War III kind of thing. So he's just doing whatever the hell he can to survive. So he's not really starting wars. He's just going wherever the resources are and taking them. So, I mean, it's dubious whether you could even call him a warlord.
If it were Outlaws of the 21st Century, that sure. name would be rocking. But sure. Warlords of the 21st Century doesn't feel right at all.
Doesn't make a lot of sense.
This is – what's really interesting about Battle Truck is it was shot at the same time they were making Road Warrior.
Which – I mean, even myself, as I'm watching this for the first time, I'm mistakenly thinking, well, this is another ripoff. I mean, we've talked about – the Italians ripping off, Road Warrior. And ripping off Escape from New York. And I'm looking at this thinking, the truck even looks like the truck from the Road Warrior that's on the poster. So obviously that's what this is. But then you do a little bit of research and you realize they started filming this movie in January of 1981 in New Zealand. And Road Warrior didn't come out, even in Australia, the first place it premiered, until December of 1981.
Yeah.
Which means they were filming at the same time in the same part of the world. But they're not. But Battle Truck is not an affectation of Road Warrior.
No. So as a result, they weren't trying to make it in a way to knock off Road Warrior. So it really is its own very similar story that tells its own thing, and it's very much unlike Road Warriors. They're traveling around and trying to get to a place. This is very much Rashomon or Seven Samurai. You know, defending. You know, the town from outlaws.
Yeah.
And it is the classic Western style, and it is a cool story, and it is just shot really well. And it's got these, a ton of just really cool characters.
Yeah.
John Ratzenberger? Is that his name?
John Ratzenberger is in this film, and he's so young that his distinctive voice isn't even there yet. You hear him talking, I'm like, that doesn't even sound like Ratzenberger. Like, I had to go back several times and make sure that I was looking at the right character played by Ratzenberger.
No, it's him, and he plays the young techie slash blacksmith in this community, and which leads into what one of the things I think I really just love about Battle Truck is. It's a very different post-apocalyptic movie.
It is.
Than any other post-apocalyptic movie out there. In most post-apocalyptic films, society collapses, everything becomes dystopian as hell, everybody turns into bandits and evil motherfuckers.
It turns into a leather bar.
And in truth, whenever societies collapse, you have issues, you have a lot of issues. You do have a lot of, loss of technology and people segmenting off and fighting. But people don't forget how to do things.
Yeah.
You know, there are still people who know how to build technology. And that's what this very much is. I mean, I love that he's, you know, Hunter in particular, I always refer to him as Montana Man, because he's not so much a post-apocalyptic badass as he is your typical guy who lives in Montana on a ranch, fucking hates everybody else, built his own house with his own two hands, makes everything himself. He rides around on a motorcycle powered by methane. How does he make the methane? Chicken shit.
Yeah.
He's a crafty guy who's got this brilliant techie down in this other village. So he goes to the other village and helps them out. They help him out.
And when they get
attacked, he comes through.
You look at his spread up there in the mountains and you look at the way it's put together and you realize that he's going to grow into Wilford Brimley from Hard Target. Like living in the mountains. First of all, I love that in Hard Target he's living in the mountains, even though the movie takes place in New Orleans.
The mountains just outside.
He's in a bayou where there are no fucking mountains. But
let's tell them the basic premise. There's these evil guys with a battle truck that drive around from town to town
looking
for gas and stealing their shit. And they pull the classic Seven Samurai thing where they come and they say, "Give us half your food and we'll be back next season."
Yeah.
And they leave. They pick up a bunch of guys to become, you know, outlaws with them, and they leave a garrison of guys behind to kind of run things. They steal the stuff. They steal all sorts of stuff. They take the technology. They take the gas. They take half the food. They rape the women. And they're like, "All right, bye." But they have an interest in this girl that's escaped from them for some reason.
Yeah.
And that girl runs across Hunter, and she and Hunter have a connection, and so Hunter keeps trying to help her out. And that is, you know, and then it's your basic town under siege story with a battle truck.
Now, again, the gasoline thing, you may think, well, that still sounds a lot like Road Warrior. Well, you have to remember that in the late 70s, the energy crisis was such a global concern that it's not outside the realm of possibility that people like George Miller and the director of this film, Harley Koklis, are letting that same fear kind of work into their creativity and work into the things that they're imagining. In fact, Harley Koklis had the idea for this movie in 1975.
Yeah.
So very much in the middle of the energy crisis. But the thing that really struck me, and this is a really weird – maybe I'm completely off on this, fine. But throughout the movie, you can hear the song Simple Gifts. Tis a gift to be simple, tis a gift to be free.
One of the weirdest parts of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not just – I thought maybe it was – okay, it's public domain. But it doesn't just appear as – ubiquitous atmosphere for the smaller moments. There's a sped up refrain that serves as a theme during an action sequence.
Yeah.
Now, that song is a Shaker hymn. And I did a little research on this song. It's a Shaker hymn. Now, if you're not familiar with the Shakers, which why would you be? Because you live now. The Shakers were a Christian sect formed in England in the 18th century. And among their tenets are things like celibacy, communal living, the renouncement of worldly goods, and equality among the sexes. Despite being an 18th century Christian-based religious sect, they actually value women equal to men. And in fact, one of their most prominent leaders was Anne Lee, which is the really remarkable thing about them, is that even in this time in history, and a Christian sect, which there's like three women in the Bible, and I think they're all whores. Like,
well, no, they're not whores in the Bible. They were named whores later,
right,
by popes.
But that's my point.
We believe that they are whores, ostensibly.
So as with many post-apocalyptic films, you do have these pockets of humanity that are living in communes. And like that's really the central focus of this movie is this commune, this sort of agrarian society that's heavily featured in Battle Truck. And not only that, but the events in the film are driven in toto by a woman. Like the woman is the catalyst for everything that happens in the movie, and the men are really just, you know, these aggressors. And John Ratzenberger has this really weird line that he says to her where he basically tells her not to sleep with any of the men in the commune when she arrives. He says, "Be friendly with the men, but not too friendly." So you have –
well, that's
– hold on.
Okay.
But you have an agrarian like commune going on where they literally have a division of labor where everyone is doing equal work regardless of sex. You have a plot that's driven entirely by a woman. You have this weird sort of thing that Ratzenberger says to her that – I don't know. It's just – it's a weird line. And then all of that going on, Simple Gifts is playing everywhere. Is this – the most Shaker-influenced post-apocalyptic film of all time? Well, and is that even a thing that can be?
I think you're right, but I think the core is that that was probably the inspiration, was this is a Shaker commune.
Yeah.
That this is, because everything you describe is this commune, you know, in this post-apocalyptic, women are valued as much as men, even more than men. In fact, that Ratzenberger line, that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, because Ratzenberger is telling her, hey, you know, everyone's going to need to get to know you, and then we'll vote on whether you get to stay or not if the community feels you're valuable. But you shouldn't have too much problem. You're a woman. We have a lot of bachelors. So be friendly, but not too friendly, not until after we have the vote.
Yeah.
Which essentially what I've always read that as him saying is he's saying, hey, don't pick a guy early because then other guys won't want you to stay. But if you're friendly with everybody and everybody thinks they have a chance, they're all going to vote you in, and then you can settle down with whoever you want to settle down with. So that was my read.
It's weird either way.
But I love that scene because that scene has kind of a harsh reality to good advice, where he's telling you, look, so many guys are going to want to sleep with you. So you'll want to use that to your advantage so that they'll vote you into the community so that you can stay with us, because Ratzenberger at the time, you know, he's good friends with Hunter. Hunter's come through for him. So whenever Hunter, you know, shows up with somebody, he takes him seriously because Hunter only brings the best people, as he says.
Yeah. Michael Beck as this sort of lone rider of the plains. I mean, that's essentially, you just swap out the horse for a motorcycle, and that's what he is. He's just this guy who lives off the land. He's sort of a lone rider who comes in and saves the day, you know, when he's not going into town for supplies, you know, much like a cowboy would. It's funny. He plays an actual cowboy in Megaforce, but I feel like this is a way more authentic cowboy role in this movie where he's not technically playing a cowboy.
It's his second coolest role.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really good as Hunter. It's not a dialogue heavy movie, but the movie is smart. Mm-hmm. The movie was put together by a couple of really talented guys, and he delivers on the silent loner charisma, and they deliver on that throughout the entire movie. This is a guy who doesn't like other people and is probably happy the post-apocalypse happened because it means no government is banging down his door. He's kind of the Tea Party ideal of, you know, what a guy's supposed to be living
on.
Off
I like him. Don't do that to me.
No. I'm talking about ideal. I'm talking about, you know, their ideal of the good, noble guy living off by himself without a government to look after him, who helps and adds to his community without having the community tax him and press him into service. He's a guy that lives on his own. He is the model for that kind of there's a certain branch of the libertarian Republican sect that he is the ideal model of. He's so good at portraying that cool and of playing the selfless hero. You buy the chemistry between him and the lead actress.
How great is Michael Beck in this role? Ed Harris interviewed for the lead role of Hunter. Michael Beck didn't have to audition. Those are facts.
Those are facts.
Battle truck facts. Oh, Michael Beck's available. Well, it's the early 80s and Michael Beck is Michael Beck. Then yes, absolutely. You cast Michael Beck.
Yeah. The guy from the Warriors. Hell yes. We cast the guy from the Warriors.
Exactly.
And you know what? And he delivers. He is great. It's what makes me sad is that everyone knows Megaforce and Xanadu better than they know Battle Truck.
Yeah.
And what also breaks my heart is that Battle Truck is only available through Shout Factory on a 2-disc set in a 4x3 format taken from an old Warlords of the 21st Century print. I swear to God, it's the print that they used for VHS.
Shout Factory, this is our formal plea to you to put Battle Truck out on a cleaned up Blu-ray. I mean, look at the work you did on Damnation Alley. Do that, but with Battle Truck. That's all we're really asking. And
Battle Truck's really good.
I agree.
It's legitimately good.
It's got that same, you know, even though it's not Road Warrior, even though it's not trying to be Road Warrior, it does have that same reckless abandon in its stunt work, which makes the movie really entertaining to watch.
There's a shot.
Yep, and I know exactly the one you're going to talk about.
There's a shot, I think, a stuntman.
He got run over. He falls off of one vehicle, and before they cut away, the one that was pursuing him runs him the fuck over. And then they just go on to the next shot. Like it was no big, apparently suddenly it's a movie filmed in Thailand and life is cheap.
Life is cheap in Thailand.
Run this guy over, and it's just like, holy shit. And oh my God, the actual destruction of the battle truck.
Oh, I mean, you're watching this movie and you're like, okay, you've got a movie that you built a battle truck. You're not going to really trash the battle truck.
Yes, they are.
Oh yes, they battle truck done gets fucked up.
Yeah.
And that slow motion final shot with battle truck. so, so pretty.
They lovingly hold on every last second of cataclysmic destruction as this truck topples over a cliff and then finally catches fire. And we get to see every flaming shard of what used to be this juggernaut just rolling down a New Zealand landscape. And they just, like, there's two cameras, and one of them is just one static shot from start to the canyon bottom. And oh my God, it was beautiful. You could tell the filmmakers were loving every second of destroying Battle Truck. And that brings us to the last film in our retrospective. And I don't know they have too terribly much to say about this one, but it is still an interesting, if nothing else, an interesting footnote in Michael Beck's career. And it's this film called Triumphs of a Man Called Horse. Now, this is the third film in a series of movies starring Richard Harris, where he plays an Englishman who essentially in the 1800s gets taken in by the Sioux Nation as one of their own, and they call him Man Called Horse.
Man Called Horse.
Man Called Horse. And this is the third film
of stilted dialogue with Native Americans talking in very bad stilted dialogue and white people in makeup making them look like Native Americans.
Look, I'm not saying that the portrayal of Native Americans in this series is offensive. I am saying that F Troop was a little more progressive with its depiction of Native Americans. Okay? Anyway, so
it's got some problems.
It's got some problems. But what's interesting about it is they bring in Michael Beck in the third film as the son of Man Called Horse.
Who they kill 30 minutes into Man Called Horse. They kill Richard Harris. Richard Harris is barely in the movie. And he's dead. And then we spend most of the rest of the movie with Michael Beck.
Michael Beck is so talented that he can kill Dumbledore. When they brought him into the series, they realized they didn't need Richard Harris anymore. So the movie completely becomes about Michael Beck trying to thwart this war between the American military and American gold rushers and the Sioux Nation. There is this greedy sort of this guy who is just trying to be the only one allowed to go after the gold in these various claims. So what he's decided to do is he's going to start a war between the military faction that's in this part of the country and all these people that have flocked here as part of the gold rush. He's going to start a war between the two of them. And when everybody's dead, him and his group are going to be the only ones that, you know.
Between that group and the Sioux Nation. Because
right. the gold was found
in the hills that are owned on a Sioux reservation.
Right.
And so the white man are coming in and going, well, we want a piece of our gold. And Michael Beck is the son of a man called Horse. And someone assassinates Man Called Horse to try to trigger the war. But, you know, people sit down and talk, wait. Man Called Horse wouldn't want this. We can't go to war over Man Called Horse. All the parts that are trying to be a good old-fashioned classic Western are really good. It's got a villain in it that makes you wring your hands and hate him.
Definitely.
And want for just a really brutal end to that guy. It's got some badass shootouts. It's got some really cool set pieces. But at the same time, it's got two major flaws. One of them is that it's like two halves of a movie pasted together. One half of the movie is about a man called Horse who's barely there and who we're talking more about than we're talking with. And then the other half of the movie is a movie about Michael Beck's character, his son, who we barely get to know before all this stuff happens. And he's just kind of an outlaw running around fucking with people to get revenge for his father in a certain way.
They really didn't know what to do with the Man Called Horse character in this movie. In fact, the weirdest thing about the film are these non-contextual flashbacks that Richard Harris keeps having before his character is killed off.
To remind the audience of who Richard Harris is and of the original movies to tie them together.
But he'll be in the – but they have no bearing whatsoever on anything that's happening to him in that moment. It's not a situation where it's like, well, you need to remember this to understand the plot of this one. It's – we're just reminding you that there were films before this.
There were a lot of non sequiturs in the movie, but so you have – two halves of a movie pasted together to make one movie. And the second thing that went wrong is almost all of the dialogue in the movie is pure exposition.
Yes.
Like it is very much people come in to tell you the exposition of what you're supposed to get out of the scene. And none of it feels like authentic dialogue.
I call that Miller's Terror, which is named after Dick Miller in the movie The Terror, when his character is pinned to a wall and forced to explain to the audience just what the fuck is happening up to that point. Yeah,
everything is so on the nose that it's just – it's That they feel like they need to tell you everything you're supposed to get out of the scene. Because I feel like it was a movie that was made for old folks. Like, yeah, it was one of those movies where it's like, look, we're just going to, this is a movie. It's going to be older folks who watch it. They just need the movie explained to them and they don't need to know much else. But the parts of it that aren't that.
The parts of it that feature Michael Beck.
Michael Beck are actually pretty decent Western stuff.
I agree.
And on the whole, when you get to the end, you're like, oh, that was decent. And the last 20 minutes were pretty badass. You know, Michael Beck starts getting tortured for the second time in two movies. He gets a red hot poker from a fire onto him.
Yeah, that's
scarring true. Scarring him for life. The five films he makes, that happens to him twice. But yeah, so it's an all right movie. Of the four of the five movies we've talked about, it's the one that you can miss.
And why is that? What is the ultimate weakness of Triumphs of a Man Called Horse?
Not enough Michael Beck.
Not enough Michael Beck.
And but here we have, we've mapped his career. Warriors makes his career, and then he's got Megaforce, the 1-2 punch of Megaforce and Xanadu, and that kills his career. And the two movies he's shooting around or just after this, neither of them connect at all. Like, nobody really saw Battle Truck, and nobody remembers it really. And Triumphs of a Man Called Horse was something that people remember seeing on television in the mid 80s.
Yeah, which the version I watched literally had like fade in, fade out for commercial breaks.
Yeah.
Which leads me to believe that this had to have been mostly broadcast on television. The ultimate problem, Triumphs of a Man Called Horse, not enough Michael Beck. The ultimate problem with the history of film, in fact, Not enough Michael Beck.
From that point on, he went on and did lots of TV appearances, lots of famous shows.
Yeah.
But, you know, one-offs or two-offs, you know. He did the occasional, you know, once every 3 to 5 years, he did a relatively unknown movie, just a small thing, usually smaller parts. And then he kind of went off the radar for a long time. He's apparently in a film coming out later this year.
The Grace of Jake is the name of that movie. And prior to that, the last thing he had done, and this will bring the episode full circle, was he provided the voice of Swan in the Warriors video game in 2005.
Yeah.
So that is Michael Beck. You guys really, if you're not familiar with his work, his career, his canon, you really need to catch up on things like Battle Truck, Megaforce, Xanadu. I'm sorry, I'm going to recommend Xanadu.
All of his work, I think, aside from Triumph of a Man Called Horse, is interesting enough to warrant really watching. And if you're a Michael Beck completist, if you decide, hey,
which everyone fucking should be,
see, well,
that's a thing
not,
you should strive to be.
You won't be too bored watching Triumph of a Man Called Horse. And by the time you get to, you know, it's always good to watch Richard Harris, because Richard Harris was the fucking man.
Yeah,
and you get some Richard Harris, you get some Michael Beck. The only thing I think is going to be a problem for people with Triumph of a Man Called Horse is the fact that Triumph of a Man Called Horse and A Man Called Horse are clearly two of the movies that really inspired Cameron for Avatar, because they're both movies about, you know, the white man coming in and, you know, the Man Called Horse, white man comes in, you know, falls in love with the squaw, he and the squaw.
Oh my God.
Yeah. End up having
I hate how right you are about this.
Having a kid, and that kid is half Sioux, half white man. So how do they tell that story without it just, you know, nobody being
without getting sued.
Well, no. How do they tell that story again? Well, this time she's not a Sioux, she's a Crow. So they're two warring tribes. So he's half white man, half Sioux, that falls in love with a Crow woman, and shows that clearly, you know, because it's a trope that works. When you need a guy to connect with people who are technically his enemy, you have them fall in love, you have them have sex, and once that happens, the audience buys you know, protecting that woman and becoming part of the family. It's like, you know, marrying into a family of another race. You're like, we're family now. And that's, you know, and that's the story of A Man Called Horse, Triumph of a Man Called Horse, and Avatar. So
and Dances with Blue Kitties.
And Dances with Blue Kitties.
Well, that's going to do it for our show this week. If you're interested in checking out any of the films we've discussed, if they happen to be available by any legal means, we have provided Amazon links to them, and we'd really appreciate you getting to Amazon via those links if you're planning to buy those films or anything, really. Cargill, we're going to close this out. Where can people find you on the internet?
People can find me at Massawyrm, MASSAWYRM, on Twitter and Facebook.com/Massawyrm. You could also check out my book, which is on sale now, Dreams and Shadows. It's $1.99 right now till the end of the month. And my book, Queen of the Dark Things, comes out in May.
You should check that out. Oh, you can find me here at FSR or at the site I co-own and manage, oneofus.net. Great posts and podcasts there weekly. That is at oneofusnet on Twitter. You can also follow me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, or again, this show at Junk Food Cinema. Junk Food Cinema is also on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Please go to iTunes and rate us and leave a review. We really appreciate that. But yeah, that's going to do it this week. So for Cargo, this is Brian reminding you that the good films can be full of wind, even if they're schlocky.